deciding to study fine arts and not knowing what was going to come and how my life was going to look like in the future at all, ever. And my parents were very supportive, but I have friends and one in particular that her parents were completely against her to do fine arts, and they were scared for it because they thought that she was not going to be able to have like a stable job and a stable future. And so they kind of forced her to do like a 2 degrees to and study marketing on the side from fine arts. So, you know, right now she's working as a graphic designer and she's keeping her practice on the side because as like 80 or 90% of artists, like they have a side job and they keep their art practice to try to make it your main action instead of like your side job. Mm-hmm. But it's a long-term process and sometimes it never arrives. You never know. Is living in the uncertain every day.
Yeah,
that's your reality.
But isn't that but isn't that called the false illusion of security? That it's true. People who have a 9-to-5 job and have like a career that's considered traditional or conservative or whatever. People who have a job that seems secure have this false sense of illusion that they know what's coming. They know what's next. Yet they also lose their jobs. They get laid off. Companies close down. Companies downsize. And things can change. And so one of the things that people end up believing is that a 9-to-5 career in a traditional industry is more secure and safer than the artist who's working on his fine arts. But in fact, part of it is a false sense of illusion. It's a false sense of security. It's an illusion of security that is not actually secure.
It's all a question of perspective then.
Yeah.
Well, our topic here today on the Multipod is talking about the nature of risk-taking, and how we approach the decisions that we make in our lives, certainly when it comes to making a living, what you do for work, or those important things, and it could be maybe just tackling hobbies and other interesting projects you want to do as well, but it comes back to often taking a risk. And what is a risk to others may seem obvious and straightforward to yourself. So we're going to explore that a bit here today, talking about some of our own personal stories. Myself, Ted, your host, and Sandrine and Sarah are with me as well. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the projects and things that we've done in our lives or that we are thinking of doing and working on, and giving you a bit of perspective on that in terms of how we approach this whole notion of risk and taking chances and how it kind of relates to the choices we make in our lives. So Sandrine is going to tell us a little bit about her story. Now, she has her own business as a personal coach, and that in itself can kind of set things up a little bit for some of the choices and commitments that she has made. But she also has some other things in mind that she's working towards, and she's going to tell us a little bit about what those things are, and then we'll kind of get into the analysis of what is risk and how to tackle and approaching organizing these projects. So Sandrine, first of all, now we know a little bit about maybe some of your background. Of course, you live in Montreal. Now, you are a life coach. Is that the best way to describe how you call yourself, if you want to give yourself a title?
No, I'm actually a business coach, and the description I always give is I have chosen the term of success instigator. And so what I do is I really work with entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs to be. Some people are in transition that I'm coaching, and they're going from, you know, having had a job and now deciding to run their own business. And so I'm helping them through that transition. But I am really working with entrepreneurs, and I, you know, my coaching does cover, if you're an entrepreneur, I will end up covering your entire life, just because as an entrepreneur, your personal life will get in the way, your entrepreneur life will get in the way of your personal life and vice versa. And so everything ends up being into one big lump, you know. But I like to work with entrepreneurs and with business owners because that's where my expertise lies, and that's what I've been doing my whole life. I've run two businesses simultaneously, and now this is my third one. And I really enjoy seeing that sparkle in the eye of somebody who has this amazing project, this amazing idea, and wants to bring it to the next level. And so that's what I do with my clients. And I do it walking and hiking outside. Okay. So every single session is outside in the outdoors.
Every single one, really?
Yeah, except, well, every single one, and the, every fourth, we end it with a half hour to 45 minutes indoors with a coffee or hot chocolate or a smoothie if it's the summer. And because then we just write down everything to make sure that we're still on target and of where we're heading. But yeah, all of our sessions are about 2 hour long and they're all walks and hikes.
Was that your idea to do it that way?
Yeah, and actually the idea came because of a health issue of mine. I hurt my back a few years ago and I can't sit for long periods of time. So I started thinking, how can I, you know, make sure that my own career doesn't force me to be sitting for long periods of time? And, but the other idea was that I read so much about the benefits of being outdoors, of walking while you think. And it really came from one article I had read about in Japan. In the last few years, doctors are giving prescriptions to their patients to go and have a walk in the forest when the person is about to go on a burnout. So if they feel that they're going to burn out, the prescription is 3 walks a week in the forest of minimum 30 minutes. That's the prescription. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. And so the benefits of walking in around nature are so many. The list is huge. I thought, well, it can only be good for somebody who's thinking of their business and trying to get to that next level.
How have your clients responded to that?
Well, actually really well. And imagine, so Ted, you'll understand where I'm coming from. I'm living in Canada and I do this in the winter as well. So of course my clients sometimes would call me and say, are we walking today? Because it's minus 25. Yes, we're walking today. Really? Outside? Yes. Dress warm, we'll walk outside and we'll finish with a nice hot chocolate. And so they sometimes, you know, we get to the parking lot and they're like, do we have to? Yes, we do. And we do. And, you know, the wonderful thing about walking, and they've all discovered this one after the other, is that it's really the contemplation. You see the beauty of nature. In the winter, you'll see the snow. If it's sunny, it'll sparkle. It looks like a gazillion diamonds on top of the snow. If it's snowing while we're walking, that's an enchanting time to be outdoors. Even if it's there's been ice, you know, you'll have the ice. It's all nice and shiny. And if it's gray and not so nice outside, well, we make it a bit shorter, but we're still breathing fresh air. We still oxygenate the brain. And so interestingly, the last benefit that I never, ever accounted for, which is an amazing benefit, is that when you're walking next to somebody and you're talking, the fact that you don't see their physical reaction to what you're saying actually allows your thought process to go to the end. So it doesn't interrupt it.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. You don't get the same kind of visual cues.
And because there are no cues, it doesn't interrupt it. You keep going. And so you get deeper in your thoughts than you would if you're sitting face to face.
It's interesting how through like a health condition from you, like you've discovered kind of like your differentiator from other possible coaches, and you are applying that to your own business.
Yeah. And it's really a condition that's non-negotiable. Like if I have a client says, oh, I don't want to walk, well, I won't work with you. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's just like that. Yeah. And that's why it also takes away the whole online thing, because if I were to do this online, I wouldn't be able to do the whole walking, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't do any of my coaching online, which brings me to my crazy project, actually.
Yeah, go for it.
A great way to integrate it, because I won't do my project online, my coaching online. I also don't want to limit myself to coaching clients only in Montreal or in the greater Montreal. So my initial idea was always to say, I'd like to serve companies that are in smaller cities, smaller towns that don't have access to coaches, because we all know that coaches are very accessible in big centers. If you're in a big city, you have access to coaches really easily. If you're in a small town in the middle of nowhere, you don't. So my idea is that I'm actually working on getting my pilot license and buying my own airplane to fly out to small cities where I can help smaller companies have access to my services.
Now, you do a bit of flying right now. You have a bit of experience, right?
I've been a glider pilot, so that's flying without an engine, for 4 years. And I started my whole transition to, it's called power flying, so flying with an engine. Mm-hmm. I started that project 3 years ago. I did my ground school 3 years ago, which is the course you have to take, which takes about 3-4 months. And then I studied for my written exam with Transport Canada. I did my first 10 hours with my instructor, flying hours. Hmm. And so I wrote my exam on April 27th, 2017. And now I have to have my license by April 27th, 2019, or else I have to start the entire process all over again.
Okay.
So that's why now my urgency is to get my own airplane, to be able to finish my hours with my instructor and get my license by the end of the summer. So, because in the winter, I won't be able to pass my exam, right? Because it's going to be impossible to go flying with an examiner in the winter, not here. And then April next year, we'll make it really, if we have a winter like this one, I'll bust through the deadline. So basically I have until give or take October 31st to get this finalized. And although it seems like a long time, I need to do 30 hours with an instructor. Well, 20 hours with an instructor, and then at least 10 to 20 hours by myself of flying time before I can call up the examiner and say, come and test me. So it doesn't seem like a lot, but the weather has to be good. It can't be extremely windy because or else it's too hard for me to learn some of the techniques I need to learn. I've got to, it can't rain, it can't hail. So your instructor has to be available. I have to be available. I can't be stuck with my kids. Like there's just a lot of things that come into. Yeah. So the conditions are so many that in the end you're like 30 hours, no problem. Yeah. Except all of a sudden the summer can go by and you've only gotten 15 done. And flying is actually something that's really, you learn through muscle memory. So if you do it every 3 days, constantly, that muscle memory will build really fast. But if you do it once a week or once every 10 days, it's almost like every time you get into the airplane, you have to relearn what you learned the last time. Mm. So your retaining of what you learned in your body and your skills and your mind leaves pretty fast. So when I learned to glide, when I got my glider license, I got it in 1 year. I got the whole thing in 1 year. I started in January. I finished in November. I was flying every 3 days. And that's why I got it so fast. So I have to do the same thing this summer, which is why it's my crazy goal, right? Because it's crazy. It's hard for me to do all this because I've got work, I've got kids, I've got so many things on the go, yet I have this deadline. And so I was thinking, for the multi-potentialites listening to this and for anybody who's got multi-interests, one of the toughest things often is to motivate yourself to get it done. But I find that sometimes making a big financial investment will be the best way to push yourself, which is why I'm buying my own airplane. Because I don't have to buy my own airplane, technically. I could rent somebody else's airplane. Mm-hmm. But forking out a bigger sum of money, like up front, to buy my own airplane, I'm not going to be happy with myself if I know my airplane's sitting in an airport doing nothing for a week because I didn't go and fly it. I'll be feeling like an idiot. I'm like, wait a minute, I put this much money and it's just sitting there and I'm not flying? That's ridiculous. So that's going to push me. I know it's going to motivate me and push me to finish it before the deadline.
How this crazy goal of flying came to be?
That's a really good question because it's a funny story. Well, it started when I was 6 years old. When I was 6 years old, my mom had a friend who had a float plane in France, and he came to see us in the bay, and he landed in the bay with his float plane, and he took us up for a ride. And I was like not even six. I think I was five. And he sat me on his lap, and he said, go ahead, fly the plane. And I took the commands, and I pulled upwards, and whew, he went flying up in the sky. My brother was in back going, don't let her fly. We're going to die. And he was freaking out, and I was having the time of my life. And I thought, oh, I want to do this. And then anyway, move over 20 years. My mom wouldn't let me fly anymore. When I was 18 years old, I still went flying, and I learned to fly paragliders. So in Spain, actually, near Madrid in Guadalajara. And I did that for 6 months and got my license, but then I left Spain, so I didn't continue flying. And then move on another 20 years. When I met my boyfriend, my current spouse, John, when we met, he's a crazy aviator. That's all he does is fly. He flies little airplanes, big airplanes, gliders. He flies anything that has wings. So he flies everything. And when we met, after like a week of dating, he said to me, he says, I have to make a deal with you. You have to shake my hand on this. If we're going to be a couple, you have to get your license. You have to learn to fly and love it. If you don't, then we're done. So I shook his hand. I said, great. I've been wanting to fly for 35 years. I'm all in. So that's how I decided to start flying. And then the other ideas came afterwards, but they're all based on flying. Yeah.
And maybe like, your project that you were going to tell us a little bit more about is also coming from this first story from you having this experience as a kid, right?
Yeah, exactly. So my project goes farther. So my project is multifold because, of course, I'm a multipotentialite. So it has to be multiple facets, right? So that one aspect is coaching clients in small towns and reaching out to people who wouldn't have access to services like mine. So that's one of the aspects of it. The other aspect of it is I was raised in a very traditional family. And my traditional family didn't believe that a woman or a girl could do these jobs that most men do, like being an airline pilot or being a stunt woman or whatever. Like, they didn't believe in that. So I was raised being told that you're a girl, you can't do that. Well, in 2018 today, lots of male-dominated industries like the airlines and the engineer forces and even the Air Force still has a percentage of women that is very, very low. We're talking 5-7% of women are pilots in the Air Force, are pilots in the civil world, are engineers. And that doesn't make any sense because there's 51% of the population is women. So it doesn't make sense. So what I'd like to do with this flying is actually combine my business coaching with a project where I think I'm going to call it like Girls Go Fly or You Go Girl Fly or something like that. And I haven't chosen a name for it yet, but because my first step is getting my license, right? And getting my airplane. Without that, I can't do the rest of the project. But the project is to go into small towns, contact schools, and while I'm there seeing clients, also go and give a presentation in a school and maybe even have like a draw where I can take up a little girl up in the air for half an hour and give her a ride. And there's actually the EAA is the Experimental Aviation Association that's worldwide. And you can, they call it Young Eagles. And you can take up kids to teach them, to show them the wonders of flying in a little airplane. So that's my project, my crazy, crazy project.
Well, it sounds it's ambitious, I suppose, but it sounds like you have the steps, you know, fairly plotted out as to what to do next and how to get from here to there to that ultimate goal.
Yeah, and that's why it's actually helping me to break it down. So one of my strategies to make this happen is to really break it down. And I've made myself, I use a productivity tool called Rike on the internet. And it's nice because it's all web-based, so I can have it on my phone, et cetera. But I've basically called it the Girls Go Fly project. And I've broken it down to every little step that I need to do. So one, do my 30 hours. One, buy my airplane. Two, do my 30 hours. Three, get my test flight out of the way before April 27, 2019. Four, keep flying my glider because if I fly my glider, I actually improve my flying skills. Five, start working with the aviation associations worldwide to see if I can get some kind of funding or some kind of help to get this girls flying project. Six, start making a list of all the schools that I want to go to. Seven, make the list of all the airports that have schools nearby so that it's easy for me to get from, because once you land at an airport, you have no car, right? So now you need somebody to pick you up at the airport to take you to the school or to the client or whatever. Seven, see which clients I'm going to have who maybe might want to help with this project and they'll be happy to contribute to this crazy project of mine. Et cetera, et cetera. Like, the list is long, but if you make that list, I find, of little steps that you have to take along the way to make it happen, it makes your project, your crazy overwhelming project, a little bit less overwhelming. I mean, when I look at it as a whole project, I freak out and I go, I'm crazy. This is nuts. Like, what am I thinking? But when I bring it down and I look at, okay, what's the next step? I'm like, yeah, the next step I can do. Like, I'm working on it. I've got it, you know? So I try not to look at the whole project too often because then I really go, and I just I end up doing nothing because I get paralyzed by the wealth, you know, of all the things that need to be done.
Mm-hmm. For me, it helps also kind of like not like avoiding to try to look at the overall or think about like a terminal goal. And it's just like, it's like taking it step by step. It's like, it's what it helped the most.
Yeah, it's a good lesson for all of us to take action and just break it down as simple and straightforward as possible, even to what you can do in a given day, given your schedule and how much free time you may have doing things on the side. Like Sarah was talking about her friend and lots of artists who have to create their art on the side when they have those free moments late in the night or, you know, weekends, of course, in between the so-called regular jobs. But that's what you got to do to keep things moving along. The first thing that comes to my mind when you talk about flying is like, isn't it super expensive? Like, isn't it a huge risk to, I mean, at least a risk in terms of spending so much money, so the perception is, to buy a plane and to like, it seems like one of those elite kind of really expensive things, but is it?
It's not. That's really the funny thing. It's not. Let me put that in quotations. It's not if you're creative about that too. So for example, I've been searching for an airplane now to buy for myself. So just to give you an example, my glider, like if the glider that I bought, okay, you can buy a glider that's coming out of the production, a brand new glider, composite ship with like all the bells and whistles for $300,000. You can't. I don't have that kind of money. So I didn't buy a ship for $300,000. I'll let you guess how much. I won't tell you the exact price, but I'll let you guess the bracket of what I have a glider. It's a single seat glider. It's a 1964. So it's an older glider, completely restored. It's got the minimal instruments that you need to fly a glider. It's perfectly certified. It's registered in Canada. It's perfectly flyable. Mm-hmm. It's in perfect shape. Like the paint is perfect. The windshield is perfect. Nothing's wrong with it at all.
I'm going to say 40,000
down.
10K
down.
Okay.
I paid less than $5,000 for my glider.
Wow.
Okay. With the trailer, with an enclosed trailer that came with it, with spare parts, with a flight suit, with all the logbooks, with a handheld radio. I got a hell of a deal. But it took me 4 years to find that glider, 4 years of research to find that glider. And it just so happened it was at the same gliding club that I was a member of, and I didn't even know it was for sale until I asked the question. So that's the crazy thing, right? So people will spend $30,000 on a car. Mm-hmm. I'll never spend $30,000 on a car, but I'll have an airplane and a glider for less than $30,000. Why? Mm-hmm. Because I'm searching, because I'm doing my research, I'm doing my due diligence, and I'm being patient with it. I'm like, I'm not going to take the first airplane. Now, the right now, actually, as we speak, I'm waiting for photos to come in of an airplane that I found online. It's in Arizona. If I buy it, I have to go to Arizona and then fly it home with my boyfriend. Cool. It's going to take me 4 days to fly it home. It'll be a great trip. But it's still an airplane that's in Arizona. It's far, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not an easy deal. But I'm getting a hell of a deal. And if I were to buy the exact same airplane with the exact same time on the engine, et cetera, in Montreal or in Canada, I'd end up paying triple that price of what I'm going to be paying for it. So it's just like, it's like everything else, right? You can buy a brand new sofa set at a store for $3,000, or you can go online and do some research and find something perfectly fine for $300. Mm-hmm. So in everything, flying can be expensive. Now, see, the airplane I'm buying has a modification. You can put car gas in it. You don't have to put aviation fuel in it. So because of that, it costs less, right? The same amount of money as putting gas in your car. And if it takes you 4 hours to get somewhere by car, but it only takes you an hour and a half to get to the same destination by airplane, well, you might pay a little bit more in gas because it's going to consume a bit more than your car. But because you're saving time, and time is money, and you're charging for your time at the other end, well, in the end, you're still benefiting from. And then there's the cost of the experience, right? So how much money are you willing to put into the experience of flying to places instead of driving there? Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at it. But so it's not... I'll never say that flying is cheaper than driving, because it's not, but it's not an elite thing either, especially in North America. In Europe, it's different, because in Europe, the regulations are different and people have to pay to be in the air. In Canada, we don't have that.
How does it feel getting the accountability out there now?
Yeah, well, now there's no turning back, but there was never any turning back, to be perfectly honest. It's funny how this whole thing, you know how this whole thing came to me? Actually, now I know how it came to me. This whole idea of this quest came from reading the Chris Guillebeau book about the happiness of pursuit. So if you've never ever read that book, it's actually an amazing book. And Chris is a friend of Emily Wapnick's as well. And I even went to see him because he wrote another book called The Side Hustle. Mm-hmm. And I went to meet with him and I told him, I said, you know, your first book, your Happiness of Pursuit book, really inspired me. I'm not sure if it was his first. I think he's written three or four now. But his book inspired me because he wrote a book because he decided to visit every single country in the world.
Right.
That was his quest. He started with like 30 countries and he ended up visiting every single one of them. It took him 10 years. And so I started thinking, wow, I would love to take off and land at every single airport in Quebec. And that's 300 airports. And then I thought, well, it's kind of silly to just go there, land, and then spend 5 minutes, take a few photos and leave. I thought, what if I actually did something there? Like actually, you know, paid forward or did something for myself or for somebody else. So then I started thinking, well, my coaching. And then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, I'd like to give back and help other girls. And it's not that I don't want to help boys, because I'm sure there's boys too that need to be motivated to do stuff for their lives. But girls have always been told that, you know, they should just do the regular girl jobs. And, you know, every girl that thinks of aviation, she thinks flight attendant. Mm. Why is it the girl thinks flight attendant and the guy doesn't? And why is it the girl doesn't think pilot and the guy does? Because they're told that if they're not good in math and they're not good in three-dimensional thinking, they can't be a pilot. Well, that's a bit of BS, actually, because you don't have to be a mathematician to be a pilot. I can name you quite a lot of pilots who are not very good at math. You just have to be able to transform your environment and have a mental picture in your head. Well, that takes training. It's not an innate thing. You're not born with that. And if you are, great. But you can learn to do that. Mm-hmm. So when I hear people saying, well, you have to have this skill set to be a pilot, my interpretation of that is you must learn these things to be a pilot. But there are things that you can learn.
Yeah,
so if you can learn them, it's given to anybody, right? It's not something you're born with. It's not like, oh, a pilot has to be born. Like, you know, in the 70s, they say, oh, if your eyesight is not 20/20, you can't be a pilot. How many pilots have glasses?
But it happens with every field. It's with art too. Like people said, like, if you don't know how to draw, you're never going to become an artist. And that's absolutely not true.
Exactly. Okay. So that's why that's how it all came about, this whole idea of, and so I've never thought I'll back out of this, because now it's been clinging to me for like 3 years. And I think that when you have a project that clings to you that long, it means that you're not going to give it up.
So what brought you to this point where you've taken the action to put yourself in place now where you have these deadlines, you're getting the word out there? What led to this point as opposed to maybe a couple years ago or another few years from now?
Quite a few things. One of them being, I'm a mom and I have a 12-year-old son, and I also have a almost 18-year-old stepdaughter. And it's probably more my stepdaughter than my son, because she's pretty lost in what she wants to do in life, which is fine because I was too at her age. I want to show both of them, but more her now because of the age she's at, that everything's possible. That it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter what your skill set is, it doesn't matter how you were raised, it doesn't matter how much money you have in your bank account. All that matters is how much effort and energy you're willing to put into something and how much of your heart and soul you're willing to devote to a dream to live it. That's all that matters. And so, of course, the first step to any of that is discovering what the dream is.
Do you think people just have to find that naturally, of course, for themselves, or do they need help in finding that dream? It seems like you should just know if you have to maybe take the time to figure out your dream, but you should be able to discover it yourself. I don't know. Maybe people need help though.
I think it's also like a matter of getting to know yourself, and like it's an inner quest at the end.
Yeah. Well, me, it was lying on the floor, staring at the ceiling because I had a back issue. That's how my dreams came about. The shaking hands with my boyfriend 6 years ago of saying, yes, I'll learn to fly. That was the first thing that triggered it. But it didn't trigger the dream. It triggered the dream of, yes, now I will fly and I'll get my license to fly. And I did. I got the glider license. But then why I wanted to get the power license was because, yeah, gliding and soaring is great. But if you want to get from one place to another, it's not ideal because you do end up needing an engine eventually, especially if you're on a schedule. Mm-hmm. So the dream of going further and pushing it further is, yeah, you're right, as Sarah said, knowing yourself. But sometimes to know yourself, life has, or you have to throw yourself some curveballs. You have to throw yourself some challenges that force you to reflect and to do that inner search. And when I hurt my back, it was the stupidest movement that actually made me discover I had a lot of things going wrong with my lower back. I was in a really good job in a really good corporate company, making quite a bit of money. And I thought I was doing what I was meant to do. And then when I ended up on my back staring at the ceiling after a couple of weeks of going through painkillers and actually being able to stop suffering so much, I thought, why am I here? why has life forced me to lie down and stare at the ceiling? Something obviously isn't right. if everything was perfect in my life, I wouldn't be in this pain and I wouldn't be staring at the ceiling and stuck on my back for 6 hours a day. So that's how I started thinking. And I think sometimes if you're not listening to the signs and if you're convincing yourself that you're in the right spot, but you're not, don't worry, your body will get your attention somehow.
But you have to be also aware and make you the right questions and be open to it, kind of. And can you open one door without closing the other?
So that's, yeah, and you can't, because so the opening door and closing the other is all about making that leap of faith and realizing that you don't know what's at the other door that you're about to open, but you'll never find out if you don't close the last door. So the analogy is really about, and I'll give you an example of how I did that, a previous transition, because I've had a few of these, but a previous transition was for me to leave a little region of the eastern townships in the eastern part of Quebec to come back to Montreal. And so I kept thinking, well, as soon as I have a job in Montreal, I'll move. And of course, I wasn't finding a job in Montreal. I kept not finding anything. And so I got a little bit anxious and I said, well, maybe I should just move. And then once I'm there, it's easier to find a job. So I called up a friend, got an apartment that I could, a bedroom that I could use on weekdays and to come back on the weekends to see my son. And so I did that. And literally within 72 hours of making that move, I got a job. So the lesson was I hadn't closed that door of where I was before. And I was keeping two doors open because of the what if. What if I move and then I don't find anything? What if I've committed myself to living every week in Montreal, but now I'm paying the other place over there and I can't do both? And what if, what if, what if? And so all these questions of what if and not believing and not making that leap of faith were leading to nothing, were leading to nothing could move. Because I don't believe the universe works in a way that it'll just help you if you're unsure. The universe will bring to you what you need when you're sure and it's clear and you've made it very clear what it is you need and you want. And I tested that like so many times. And that was one of the last times I tested it. And it worked like magic. It worked like a magic wand. It was literally, I called up my friend. I said, I'm going to Montreal. I'll be there Sunday night. Monday, I was there. Tuesday, I was sitting with a company that called me to do a contract on the Monday. And Wednesday, they had a position for me for 4 weeks, which ended up being a 4-month position. So until you're there, nothing's going to happen. And so, you know, Warren Buffett always says 90% of life is about showing up. And it's the same thing about closing doors and opening new ones. You can't open the door and leave all the doors open and expect the universe to know what it is you want. Because all you're sending the universe is, you know what? I don't know what I want. So send me whatever. And what is he going to send you? He's going to send you more. I don't know.
Did you ever feel in retrospect, looking back on that experience, that things happen at the right time?
Oh, yeah. It was incredible because that actually, my moving triggered my boyfriend to finally move in with me. And then his daughter finally spending half the time with him because now he had another place to be in. So he was seeing his daughter more. Then it triggered my son coming to live with me full time because he missed me and wanted me to be with him. And so that gave him clarity. That gave stability to everybody because now everybody was going to schools and everything was more settled down. So, wow, everything just evolved from there on onwards, really. And then after that 4-month contract was up, that's when I was able to get the other job that I got in the big corporate company, which lasted 4 years. I mean, you know, obviously it wasn't meant to be forever, but it gave me 4 years of amazing experience and great learning as well. Mm-hmm.
when you go into the rabbit hole of the what if factor, it's kind of like it's hard to get out of there.
Yeah, you're right. And so I'll quickly speak of another experience in my life where I didn't allow myself to go in the what if, because it was with regards to my pregnancy. When I got pregnant with my son, so just so you know, I'm a real chicken when it comes to health and medical stuff. Like, I can't stand a blood test. I can't stand a vaccination. I can't stand needles. I just, I freak out with everything that's medical. You can barely touch me. So I'm a real wuss when it comes to that. And so I got pregnant with my son and I thought, okay, I don't want to be in a hospital when I give birth because they're going to stick needles in me. And I don't want those. So I have to give birth naturally. And I remember thinking, what if I can't? What if I don't have the strength? What if I faint? What if, and I just came into the what ifs. And then I thought, hang on, how many millions of women have done this before me? Like millions, like billions of women have done this before me naturally without going into a hospital. So if they can, so can I. And that was the end of the what if. And so now I've used that every single time I've gone down the what if rabbit hole. I've always gone back to, you gave birth to your son naturally. You didn't need any medication. You didn't need anything in your spinal cord. You didn't need any help from any doctor. You did it. So guess what? If you can do that and you can give life, you can do anything.
And that makes me think about, you know, there's anything new under the light of the sun. So probably if you're thinking about it, somebody else has thought about it and probably done it. And it is also maybe making me think about something we were talking about earlier is like, if you want to do something and you're in this community, you know, that they are doing like the standard things and you want to do this different thing, sometimes it's good to like find yourself like other communities and design yourself like the architecture of the community you want to be in.
Yeah, it's very powerful to be around like-minded people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, one of the things that I think stops people from doing crazy things and living crazy dreams and allowing themselves to start on crazy adventures is really most of the time the people around them. And and don't get me wrong, our families and friends, they don't want to harm us or be bad with us by saying things that they say. But a lot of their advice or their comments are their own background, their own life experience, their own fears, their own worries of what they've gone through. But that's just projecting what they went through onto you. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, I'm always, and you know, I have my days too, where I have lack of belief that I'll make it to the end of my project. And you know, there's moments where I'm like, oh, you're crazy. This is just never going to happen. But then I think, hang on, you know, was Bill Gates thinking that when he was 15 years old and had dropped out of school? Was Céline Dion thinking that when she was 13 years old? There are lots of role models out there of people everywhere in the world who have done some incredible things with their lives. I think of a guy named Trevor Noah who wrote a book called Born a Crime. This guy was born in South Africa of a black mother and a white father, and he risked getting killed every day of his life as he was growing up. And now he's the show host on a TV show, and he writes books and he does stand-up comedy. And man, he was doomed to die before he was 18. Mm. if he can do it, so can I, you know? So it's really the question of thinking, how many people out there have done incredible things, and have they taken risks? Hell yes. Have they been challenged? Absolutely. Have they failed a million times over before actually succeeding? Absolutely. But failure is your best friend. Like failure is your best friend when you're going through this. When I was learning to glide, there was so many times where my landings were awful and I would land and I would get out of the airplane and like fall in tears and go, I'll never be a pilot. I'll never get this. It's never going to sink in. And I was like, just a really bad day. And then I remember walking to the clubhouse and seeing some club members going, so are you enjoying your training? Do I look like I'm enjoying my training?
It's a roller coaster.
Puffy eyes and a red nose. What do you think this face says? Yeah, absolutely. I'm loving every minute of it. But you know, they would say that and then it would sink in after the anger. It would be like, you know, they're right. I should be enjoying the process. And so I learned to enjoy the process. And so now I'm at that again. Now I'm learning powered flying, and it's still flying, but your landings and your takeoffs are different. And you got to manage the engine. And if you have an engine failure, you have to know what to do and blah, 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 blah. And all that, that's a challenge after another challenge. But you know what? At the end, it makes the success even sweeter, because once you do get that license, and once you do like 10 landings that are perfect, you go, oh my God, you're so proud of yourself, because you're like, wow, I did this. Mm-hmm. I did this. Nobody else did this. I did it. And that feeling of satisfaction cannot be replaced by any amount of money. It can't be replaced by anybody else giving you satisfaction. It's you with yourself. And that's the biggest, I think that's the biggest drug in the end of them all, about these dreams and these crazy projects.
Taking rest by the horns.
The other thing that strikes me too is time, you know, when you take little pieces of action, little steps, and then you look back a few weeks, a few months, or a couple years later, and you realize simply by doing that, you've come so far. That's a great feeling. That makes you realize that, thank goodness that you started, even though it seemed so small and so simple at the time. Look how far you've come now. And of course, you know, maybe you compare it to other things where you didn't take action, or they're still stalling. It really comes back to what we started here, and the notion of what is risk. And I like to ask myself, not so much what do I have to lose if I have a big decision or a commitment kind of thing to make. I like to ask myself, what's the worst that can happen? What's really the worst that can happen? It depends on the situation. And, you know, the more serious, if you're talking lots of money or maybe health or putting yourself in some kind of jeopardy or risk, then, well, what's the worst that can happen? And you have to look at it in that context. But, you know, at the end of the day, maybe it's, what are you willing to lose? What are you willing to change and adapt if things really go bad? Probably the odds are they won't really be that bad. And you may actually achieve the thing that you're, you know, dreaming of doing. So I like to ask myself that question.
That's actually a really good question about what's the worst that can happen, because oftentimes the worst that can happen is not that bad. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be like, oh, I'll die, you know. It won't be that, you know. It'll usually be like, okay, I'll have tried this and it didn't work out. But you'll learn things along the way. You'll meet people along the way. You'll discover things about yourself along the way. And it'll open other doors that you had probably never even imagined would have opened. Mm-hmm. So it's always a win-win-win. Like, it's never a complete loss. And that's the good thing you were saying about looking back. You know, sometimes you look back in your life and you go, I remember when I lost my job, I was all pissed off because I got laid off and da-da-da-da-da. And you're all like in this nightmare situation going, oh my God, how am I going to make ends meet? And then 3 years go by and it was actually the best thing that ever happened to you, because it allowed you to do this and that and train for something else and go on to something that you would have never dreamt you could have done. So in retrospect, all of these hardships end up being amazing lessons and amazing opportunities. And so I really try as often as I can to, whenever something becomes a challenge and becomes difficult, I always try to think, okay, get past that moment, like be in the present moment, live your emotion now, but don't linger on it, because you know that in due time, you'll look back and go, wow, that was a great opportunity in the end. Mm-hmm. But at the very moment when you're living it, it's hard to see that, because you're in that moment of frustration or of anger or of disbelief or of denial. But once you get past that mode, you realize, wow, now I know why this happened and it's all good.
So if you know that you're going to come through it probably in the end and it's going to work out in some shape or form, then you think back, say, I should have enjoyed the journey. So now for the next time that happens, it's like I'm in the midst of something that's a big challenge or whatever, but it's going to work out. So I am going to enjoy the journey, even if there's, you know, a lot of peaks and valleys and so on.
Even if you don't know if it's going to work out, it's just like a matter of like knowing if it means something to you, you want to give it a try. You know every day is going to be like a roller coaster, and there's going to be days that you're going to be like high and excited and like going all for it. And it's just, there's going to be days that you're going to be like full of doubts. And it's like, is this really worth it? Everything at the end is like a lesson, and failure is just a huge teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because I'm, reading a book from a lady called Danielle Henkel. She's a French woman here who's really, really popular because she's a businesswoman who's been on like the Dragon's Den, but the French version in Quebec. And she says that fear of failure, fear of success, fear of all types of fear she used to hate fear. And now she says she's learned to make it her best friend along her journey. So she says, I love the fact that fear is with me at all times because that's what keeps me on my toes. That's what keeps me true and real. That's what keeps me engaged. And it's knowing that I'm never overconfident, that I'm never thinking I'm on top of everything and everything's going to go fine, because that's when I'm too much in my comfort zone and I'm going to fail for sure. Mm-hmm. And so although, you know, failure is also a really important thing that she says, you know, I like to fail because I learn so much. But I keep fear close at hand because it really makes me feel like, you know what? You don't have this. You're not fully in control and it's okay. So that's another thing that I find is interesting, because I used to also have this thing with fear where I was like, oh, I don't want to feel fear. I don't want to be afraid of anything. But actually being a little bit afraid of something is actually a good thing.
It keeps you humble.
You know, you guys got me realizing that I really put it out there now and I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, this goes out around the world, you know.
Yeah, honestly, yeah. So it's good, I guess. Yeah, it was spontaneous when today we started talking about. It's because you guys showed me that thing about Kiki, and I was like, "Holy cow!" Or somebody mm-hmm. showed me that thing about Kiki. Or you talked about it. You're the one. Yeah, you're the one who started the whole ball. It's all your fault. Yay! I'm happy it's my fault. See the fear factor? Here it is. Ah!
Yeah, was it Kiki on the Putty Tribe forum? She was talking about the power of bold questions, I think it was, and challenging.
Yeah.
The crazy questions.
Yeah.
Like, or the nonsense questions. You never know. It's a question can trigger the whole adventure.
Yeah, crazy.
It's been neat to dive some more into Sandrine's stories and plans. So I've really enjoyed that with this episode and learning a bit more about your story and also the things you have going on. And I mean, I, you know, when I hear your plans for the flying, I mean, I see it's a big project. It doesn't seem to me something that's particularly risky. You seem to certainly have it plotted out as best you can in terms of the steps you need to take, you know, and of course there's money involved, but you have a plan. So it's a question of, is it really risk or is it just a great adventure? I think it sounds like a great adventure. So we looked at
it. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I'll remember that when I'm thinking I'm risking way too much here. No, I think the only risk factor is, the risk factor really lies in the capacity to fly to so many different destinations and have the weather be as often as possible on my side. Cause that, I mean, I'm, you know, I can fly IFR eventually. I'll fly. So in through cloud, and when you don't see anything outside, you have instruments, you fly on instruments. So I can do that, but not every airplane is capable of that. So I have to think really far down the road and go, you know what, eventually if I want to go to places where the weather is tough, then I'll need another airplane. So I'll have to sell that one and buy a better airplane that can do that. So it's just the risk factor is more with regards to my overall dream. That's reaching as many places as I can because of that, the fact that, you know, for example, in the Inuit community up north Quebec, I know the one girl who's been now promoted to captain left seat, who's a new Inuit. There's only one woman that's ever become an airline captain pilot with Air Inuit. And she just finished her first year in the left seat. Well, that's crazy that in 2018, it's taken that long to have one girl, right? So she's making a difference in that community. But, you know, they basically know of one single woman that's ever done that. So those places are hard to reach. And yeah, the easy way would be to just get on an airline and go there. But that's not half. That's not the goal. No. So that's the risk. That's the risk factor. But you're right. It's mainly a great adventure.
Well, it's out there now. So we're gonna hear how it goes over the next few months. It's going to go by fast.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I actually, you know, I've been thinking of starting a blog about it to just kind of document how things are going. Mm-hmm. But I had made it a point of honor to say, I'm only going to start a blog once I have my license in hand. So as soon as my license is in hand, then I can say, yep, I'm a pilot. And there's my project.
Sounds perfect. And the best of luck with it. I'm sure you're gonna get it.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks to both of you.
Do you want to do a tip of the week this week?
So for my tip of the week, I think the best thing would be for all of you who've been listening to this, take whatever tip that I've already mentioned in this episode that Sarah's mentioned, that Ted has mentioned, and just, you know, adopt it if it works for you and if it can help you live your crazy dreams and your crazy adventures. And just do it.
Sounds good. Just do it. All right. Well, I'm going to go do some Putty P profiles now, see who's in the spotlight last couple of weeks. And then we'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode.
Yay. That's going to be so much fun. We have to think of a next subject. So if you're excited about a subject that you'd want us at the Multipod to talk about, please, by all means, let us know through the forum, through private messages. We're always happy to hear from you and for you to give us some ideas on topics.
Yep.
Thank you all for listening.
In our Putty Pete profiles for this episode, we start with Sharon Ternoy, who has lived in San Jose, Washington State, Santa Cruz, and San Diego. You can find her at LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/SharonTurnoy, Turnoy, and also Twitter, @STurnoy. A couple of things about her profile jump out for me. Well, she says she loves to travel and a jazz buff, so we have those things in common. I wonder what type of jazz. I listen more to jazz rock myself, perhaps, but always appreciate the Dave Brubecks, the Miles Davises, the Oscar Petersons of the jazz world, so curious to see what she is interested in. Something else that jumps out from her bio, she mentions biracial relationships and being the mother of two grown biracial Stanford graduates. That's an experience and perspective I would love to explore further. A dream of mine is to spend some time in the southern U.S. in African-American communities, the birthplace of jazz and so much culture, and try to understand more the struggle and the joy that is fundamental to it. So when Sharon includes the biracial experience in her bio, it definitely jumps out for me, and I'm curious to learn more. And then we have Harsh Chawla, who is currently into human Swiss Army knives, upgrading tech skills, and rocking the last Puttython. He lives in New Delhi, places he lived in the past, New Delhi, but he says he's also traveled to the U.S. in 2010. Link to any personal websites. Well, he mentions Goodreads, where you can review books and so on, so you can look for some of his reviews there. Goodreads.com/HarshVChawla, HarshVChawla, all one word. What jumps out for me? He's from New Delhi, the land of spices. I can taste them now. I remember being in India and how even a simple reheated meal at a hole-in-the-wall restaurant in India still tastes amazing. So I experienced that in New Delhi. One interesting quote or fact from his bio. Well, what is this Swiss Army knife thing? He says it's dabbling with different technologies he studied in the past, but none really enticed him to do a deep dive, and so he feels kind of a jack of all trades and calls it the human Swiss Army knife. It's another term for multipotentialites. Well, that wraps up this episode, episode number 9 of the Multipod. It was a little different this time. We tried to track down a couple guests, and it didn't work out in the end. But in fact, it was just as well, because we could really explore some of Sandrine's story there and the projects that she's got going on, and, of course, some of her background as well. She was away for a couple episodes over the last month or so, and so it's just as well that we could have that time with her and give her the mic and learn some more of her story. So, and lots of actionable tips, as to say in there, lots of inspiration and hopefully some takeaways as we all try to juggle those projects, take chances, and determine what really is a risk, what makes a risk. And I suppose if there's any real fundamental lesson from all of this, it's that you don't get anything if you don't take any chances. Maybe there's different types of risk, calculated risks and so on. But taking action and making the effort and getting out there and trying something is the best thing we can all do. I look forward to sharing more of our own stories as we progress with our show here, and of course, getting some more guests on to share theirs. So as we say all the time, you're welcome to join us here on the Multipod. Send us a message. We do have a new landing page. It's basically the homepage for the show, and it's at theputtytribe.com/themultipod, all one word, the multipod. So that's where you can check out the show. You can see all of our backdated episodes back to the very first one. It's all there. There's a built-in player. And, of course, you can still find the show on Apple Podcasts and other apps. I use Overcast myself, and the same thing just kind of taps into the show, and you can load all the episodes, listen to it in the car, and so on. But, yeah, it's neat that we do have our own little website now, and you can leave comments and so on for each episode. So you can reach us there. This we have a Gmail address. We've launched that as well. You can send us an email anytime, themultipodcast@gmail.com. Again, all one word, themultipodcast@gmail.com. We love our wordplay here. So feel free to reach out. This is your show just as much as it's our show. And it's always exciting to come up with new topics and see what we're going to explore next. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.